Scottish Qualifications Authority, National Qualifications 2012. English for Speakers of Other Languages, Intermediate 2. Section A, Listening. Recording 1. Listen to the talk. Answer the questions which follow. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in Section A, Recording 1, before you hear the recording.
This is Class 5B, Design and Technology Presentations, 17th of March. Jan Belina? Okay, Jan.
Hi. Now, for my presentation, I'd like to talk about the future of the airship. Let me get the first slide up. This is a picture of maybe the most famous airship in history, the Hindenburg. So, as you can see, an airship is basically a big sausage-shaped balloon. However, in May 1937, as it was landing in the United States, the Hindenburg caught fire and crashed. About a third of the 97 people on board died, and all of this was captured on film because there was a news team there. The radio commentary, which was broadcast the next day, is very dramatic, and after that, nobody was interested in airships. The Hindenburg was German, and Britain had pulled out of airship construction even earlier, after an airship called the R101 crashed in France in 1930. There had been some successes, though. In 1919, the British R34, took off from near Edinburgh and flew to New York. But this was rather overshadowed by the fact that two men, John Alcock and Arthur Brown, had made the first flight across in a plane a few weeks before. However, they had flown from the United States to Britain, so the R34 made the first flight from east to west. And the Hindenburg, before she crashed, made a number of passenger trips from Germany to Brazil and the United States. But at the end of the 1930s, governments and the people took the view that airships weren't safe. There were two problems. One was that the materials and construction techniques just weren't advanced enough at the time. One British airship, the R38, actually broke in half during a test flight in 1921. Here's a picture of the crash. The other problem was the gas used to lift them. The safest gas for airships is helium, because it doesn't burn. Helium is found underground in oil fields, but almost all of these are in the United States. In the 1930s, the Americans wouldn't export helium to Germany because they thought the Germans would use airships for military purposes. So the Hindenburg was filled with hydrogen, and hydrogen is highly flammable. However, some designers are thinking that hydrogen might still be the way forward if it can be stored safely, because it costs much less to produce. And, obviously, it should be possible to build a modern airship that won't simply break up in flight. So what are the advantages of airships? Well, they use much less fuel than planes. You could say that their carbon footprint is very small, and airships don't need a runway. You can land almost anywhere. This would be especially useful after natural disasters. Airships could bring supplies in when the roads have been destroyed by an earthquake or couldn't be used because of flooding. They also have advantages over ships. They're much faster, for a start, and if you're bringing goods in by ship, you still have the problem of moving them overland from the port to where they're needed. An airship can put them down in exactly the right place. Whether the airship will have a role in passenger transportation is another question. They're much slower than planes, and a trip from London to New York would take 2 days.
This is Class 5B, Design and Technology Presentations, 17th of March. Jan Belina? Okay, Jan.
Hi. Now, for my presentation, I'd like to talk about the future of the airship. Let me get the first slide up. This is a picture of maybe the most famous airship in history, the Hindenburg. So, as you can see, an airship is basically a big sausage-shaped balloon. However, in May 1937, as it was landing in the United States, the Hindenburg caught fire and crashed. About a third of the 97 people on board died, and all of this was captured on film because there was a news team there. The radio commentary, which was broadcast the next day, is very dramatic, and after that, nobody was interested in airships. The Hindenburg was German, and Britain had pulled out of airship construction even earlier, after an airship called the R101 crashed in France in 1930. There had been some successes, though. In 1919, the British R34, there she is, took off from near Edinburgh and flew to New York. But this was rather overshadowed by the fact that two men, John Alcock and Arthur Brown, had made the first flight across in a plane a few weeks before. However, they had flown from the United States to Britain, so the R34 made the first flight from east to west. And the Hindenburg, before she crashed, made a number of passenger trips from Germany to Brazil and the United States. But at the end of the 1930s, governments and the people took the view that airships weren't safe. There were two problems. One was that the materials and construction techniques just weren't advanced enough at the time. One British airship, the R38, actually broke in half during a test flight in 1921. Here's a picture of the crash. The other problem was the gas used to lift them. The safest gas for airships is helium, because it doesn't burn. Helium is found underground in oil fields, but almost all of these are in the United States. In the 1930s, the Americans wouldn't export helium to Germany because they thought the Germans would use airships for military purposes. So the Hindenburg was filled with hydrogen, and hydrogen is highly flammable. However, some designers are thinking that hydrogen might still be the way forward if it can be stored safely, because it costs much less to produce. And, obviously, it should be possible to build a modern airship that won't simply break up in flight. So what are the advantages of airships? Well, they use much less fuel than planes. You could say that their carbon footprint is very small, and airships don't need a runway. You can land almost anywhere. This would be especially useful after natural disasters. Airships could bring supplies in when the roads have been destroyed by an earthquake or couldn't be used because of flooding. They also have advantages over ships. They're much faster, for a start, and if you're bringing goods in by ship, you still have the problem of moving them overland from the port to where they're needed. An airship can put them down in exactly the right place. Whether the airship will have a role in passenger transportation is another question. They're much slower than planes, and a trip from London to New York would take 2 days.
Recording 2. Listen to the discussion. Answer the questions which follow. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in Section A, Recording 2, before you hear the recording.
Good morning. I'm Terry Roberts and welcome again to Listen In. Today we are going to discuss how fewer and fewer children play outside and engage with the natural world. Recent studies have shown that this is having a huge impact on their health and development. To look at the reasons for this trend, we have in the studio Stephen Murray, naturalist, broadcaster and author, and Anna Taylor, a representative of the Parents Today Association. Hi Stephen. Tell us about your findings and why the way children spend their free time nowadays has changed so much in the last 40 years.
Hi. Well, what the survey has shown is that in the last year, 64% of children today play outdoors less than once a week. 28% have not been on a country walk, and 20% have never once climbed a tree. Another interesting fact is that 71% of their parents, as children, played outdoors regularly.
So, why is this the case?
One main reason is stranger danger, the fear of abduction by an unknown adult. This results in many parents not allowing their children out unsupervised. Another explanation is the increase in road traffic. But, while recognising that these anxieties are justified, I do firmly believe that these are obstacles which would be overcome if parents realised the hugely positive impact playing outdoors has on their children.
I'm sorry, Stephen. Solving these problems is more complex. To begin with, there was a real community spirit 40 years ago which no longer exists. As a result, this stranger danger fear is very real amongst parents and not one which will disappear easily. And yes, as you admit yourself, there are great concerns regarding the huge volume of traffic on roads, and so parents, once again, are justified in their reluctance to allow their children to play freely in the streets. Added to all of this is the majority of parents work and prefer their children to take part in more structured activities simply because these are compatible with parents' schedules.
Of course, I think we all agree that there are increased worries in terms of traffic accidents, but surely children must be exposed to certain situations in order to develop a sense of awareness and be able to take responsibility and make decisions for themselves. Stephen?
Yes, and this is a problem that we need to address. Climbing a tree, for example, is about learning to take responsibility for yourself and how, crucially, to measure risk for yourself. Another negative effect that the lack of outdoor play has had on children is the increase in child obesity. This is possibly the most visible symptom of how children are engaging less and less in outdoor physical activity. A recent study revealed that just 5 minutes green exercise can produce improvements in mental well-being, with the greatest benefits experienced by the young.
I'm not disagreeing with the fact that outdoor play can be beneficial to children, but I believe, for example, that my own children who participate in organised after-school and weekend activities use their free time constructively and obtain an ideal amount of exercise. Also, if they are supervised properly while using much criticised media entertainment, then there is no reason why they shouldn't spend some time improving their computer skills at home.
Okay, I can see what you're saying, but you may well be missing the point. The American Medical Association has published a study which concluded that unstructured play in the outdoors boosts problem-solving skills, focus, and self-discipline. And socially, it improves cooperation, flexibility, and self-awareness. Also, the emotional benefits include increased happiness. So actually, there is no substitute for outdoor play.
Anna and Stephen, thank you very much for your contributions, but I need to stop you there as we've run out of time. Good morning. I'm Terry Roberts and welcome again to Listen In. Today we are going to discuss how fewer and fewer children play outside and engage with the natural world. Recent studies have shown that this is having a huge impact on their health and development. To look at the reasons for this trend, we have in the studio Stephen Murray, naturalist, broadcaster and author, and Anna Taylor, a representative of the Parents Today Association. Hi Stephen. Tell us about your findings and why the way children spend their free time nowadays has changed so much in the last 40 years.
Hi. Well, what the survey has shown is that in the last year, 64% of children today play outdoors less than once a week. 28% have not been on a country walk, and 20% have never once climbed a tree. Another interesting fact is that 71% of their parents, as children, played outdoors regularly.
So, why is this the case?
One main reason is stranger danger, the fear of abduction by an unknown adult. This results in many parents not allowing their children out unsupervised. Another explanation is the increase in road traffic. But, while recognising that these anxieties are justified, I do firmly believe that these are obstacles which would be overcome if parents realised the hugely positive impact playing outdoors has on their children.
I'm sorry, Stephen. Solving these problems is more complex. To begin with, there was a real community spirit 40 years ago which no longer exists. As a result, this stranger danger fear is very real amongst parents and not one which will disappear easily. And yes, as you admit yourself, there are great concerns regarding the huge volume of traffic on roads, and so parents, once again, are justified in their reluctance to allow their children to play freely in the streets. Added to all of this is the majority of parents work and prefer their children to take part in more structured activities simply because these are compatible with parents' schedules.
Of course, I think we all agree that there are increased worries in terms of traffic accidents, but surely children must be exposed to certain situations in order to develop a sense of awareness and be able to take responsibility and make decisions for themselves. Stephen?
Yes, and this is a problem that we need to address. Climbing a tree, for example, is about learning to take responsibility for yourself and how, crucially, to measure risk for yourself. Another negative effect that the lack of outdoor play has had on children is the increase in child obesity. This is possibly the most visible symptom of how children are engaging less and less in outdoor physical activity. A recent study revealed that just 5 minutes green exercise can produce improvements in mental well-being, with the greatest benefits experienced by the young.
I'm not disagreeing with the fact that outdoor play can be beneficial to children, but I believe, for example, that my own children who participate in organised after-school and weekend activities use their free time constructively and obtain an ideal amount of exercise. Also, if they are supervised properly while using much criticised media entertainment, then there is no reason why they shouldn't spend some time improving their computer skills at home.
OK, I can see what you're saying, but you may well be missing the point. The American Medical Association has published a study which concluded that unstructured play in the outdoors boosts problem-solving skills, focus and self-discipline. And socially, it improves cooperation, flexibility and self-awareness. Also, the emotional benefits include increased happiness. So actually, there is no substitute for outdoor play.
Anna and Stephen, thank you very much for your contributions, but I need to stop you there as we've run out of time.
Recording 3. Listen to the discussion. Answer the questions which follow. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in Section A, Recording 3, before you hear the recording.
So we'll see some very heavy rain through Tuesday night into Wednesday morning, spreading across the whole of the UK. Now back to you, Jeremy.
Thank you, Gillian. Now, just to remind you, you're listening to Capital Radio 6, and it's time now for Out and About with Paul Farini.
Hello, welcome. Well, for today's programme, I'm in Yorkshire, on the East Coast. I'm standing on a beach a couple of miles north of the town of Hornsea. Up the coast, about 20 miles north, is the town of Bridlington, and about the same distance to the south is another town, within sea. Above the beach, there are cliffs, about 20 meters high, and there's something special about this whole coast. Now, with me is Tricia Kendrick, who works for the National Coastal Survey, and she's going to tell us more about it. Good morning, Tricia.
Hi, Paul. Well, take a look at the cliff over there. Halfway down it, tell me what you can see.
It looks to me like a lamppost, but it's sticking out of the cliff. It's almost horizontal.
Yes. Any ideas how that happened?
Well, the cliff looks quite soft. It isn't rock, it looks like earth.
Well, not actually earth. It's a mixture of clay and gravel. But yes, it's soft, and the sea is washing it away.
And that lamppost once stood on top of the cliff, but the cliff collapsed underneath it, and it fell over the edge?
That's right. This coast is eroding very quickly. The sea is taking it away about 2 metres every year. In fact, it's the fastest eroding coast in Europe. Let's walk on a bit. I've got something else to show you. Now, tell me what you think this is.
Okay. I'm looking at a great big piece of concrete, about 1.5 metres by 2 metres. It's about halfway down the beach. What is it?
Well, it was built in 1939 at the start of the Second World War. It's part of a concrete box that had a big gun inside.
So it used to stand on top of the cliff?
Exactly.
But the cliff's, well, over 100 metres away now.
Oh, I can do better than that. Look out to sea, over there.
Yes?
1,000 years ago, this coast was 2 miles further out to sea. There were at least a dozen villages that have now disappeared. One of them, Owthorne, a few miles south of here, was lost just a couple of 100 years ago. The sea got closer and closer, then a great storm took part of the village away, and very soon after that the rest of it disappeared into the sea.
But could that happen today? I mean, are the coastal towns and villages safe?
Well, they all have sea defences, but you can't protect the whole coast, and eventually the sea will take the land on either side, but I don't think it'll happen in our lifetimes.
Are you sure about that? What about global warming, rising sea levels?
Well, certainly there seems to be a connection, and rising sea levels will obviously speed things up, but it's still going to take some time. At the end of the last ice age, 12,000 years ago, this whole area was covered by glaciers, big mountains of ice. When the ice melted, all the clay and gravel that was carried with it was left behind, and that's the problem. There's no harder land until you get to a band of chalk, about 15 miles inland from here.
So, eventually that 50 miles of country will disappear into the sea?
Yes, it'll just be washed away. But that should take a few thousand years.
Well, we can only hope so. Thanks, Tricia.
So we'll see some very heavy rain through Tuesday night into Wednesday morning, spreading across the whole of the UK. Now back to you, Jeremy.
Thank you, Gillian. Now, just to remind you, you're listening to Capital Radio 6, and it's time now for Out and About with Paul Farini.
Hello, welcome. Well, for today's programme, I'm in Yorkshire, on the East Coast. I'm standing on a beach a couple of miles north of the town of Hornsey. Up the coast, about 20 miles north, is the town of Bridlington, and about the same distance to the south is another town, Withernsea. Above the beach, there are cliffs, about 20 meters high, and there's something special about this whole coast. Now, with me is Tricia Kendrick, who works for the National Coastal Survey, and she's going to tell us more about it. Good morning, Tricia.
Hi, Paul. Well, take a look at the cliff over there. Halfway down it, tell me what you can see.
It looks to me like a lamppost, but it's sticking out of the cliff. It's almost horizontal.
Yes. Any ideas how that happened?
Well, the cliff looks quite soft. It isn't rock, it looks like earth.
Well, not actually earth. It's a mixture of clay and gravel. But yes, it's soft, and the sea is washing it away.
And that lamppost once stood on top of the cliff, but the cliff collapsed underneath it, and it fell over the edge?
That's right. This coast is eroding very quickly. The sea is taking it away about 2 metres every year. In fact, it's the fastest eroding coast in Europe. Let's walk on a bit. I've got something else to show you. Now, tell me what you think this is.
Okay. I'm looking at a great big piece of concrete, about 1.5 metres by 2 metres. It's about halfway down the beach. What is it?
Well, it was built in 1939 at the start of the Second World War. It's part of a concrete box that had a big gun inside.
So it used to stand on top of the cliff?
Exactly.
But the cliff's, well, over 100 metres away now.
Oh, I can do better than that. Look out to sea, over there.
Yes?
1,000 years ago, this coast was 2 miles further out to sea. There were at least 12 villages that have now disappeared. One of them, Owthorn, a few miles south of here, was lost just a couple of 100 years ago. The sea got closer and closer, then a great storm took part of the village away, and very soon after that the rest of it disappeared into the sea.
But could that happen today? I mean, are the coastal towns and villages safe?
Well, they all have sea defences, but you can't protect the whole coast, and eventually the sea will take the land on either side, but I don't think it'll happen in our lifetimes.
Are you sure about that? What about global warming, rising sea levels?
Well, certainly there seems to be a connection, and rising sea levels will obviously speed things up, but it's still going to take some time. At the end of the last ice age, 12,000 years ago, this whole area was covered by glaciers, big mountains of ice. When the ice melted, all the clay and gravel that was carried with it was left behind, and that's the problem. There's no harder land until you get to a band of chalk, about 15 miles inland from here.
So, eventually that 50 miles of country will disappear into the sea?
Yes, it'll just be washed away. But that should take a few 1,000 years.
Well, we can only hope so. Thanks, Tricia.
You now have 1 minute to check your answers. This is the end of the listening test.